From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Today, the man John Grisham describes as the dean of all innocence advocates. Over 40 years ago, when Jim McCluskey was a seminary student at Princeton, he became the student chaplain at a prison. His experiences there led him to abandon his plan to become a minister. Instead, he's dedicated his life to seeking justice, freedom, and exoneration for men and women on death row or serving life sentences for crimes they did not commit. McCluskey founded the group Centurion Ministries, which has succeeded in reopening many cases leading to exoneration. But he says his faith has been shaken many times. He's written a new memoir. Later, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the new album by Haim, a group of three sisters. The album includes songs about depression, loneliness, and dealing with condescending journalists. My guest, Jim McCluskey, is part detective, part man of God. While studying at Princeton Theological Seminary, planning to become an ordained minister, he did field work at a prison. There he met a man serving a life sentence for murder, a man who convinced McCluskey he was innocent. McCluskey took a leave from Princeton to work on this case and somehow succeeded, although he had no legal background. It led McCluskey to found one of the first innocence projects, Centurion Ministries, dedicated to reopening the cases of men and women unjustly convicted of murder. John Grisham calls McCluskey the dean of all innocence advocates, the exonerator. In McCluskey's new memoir, When Truth Is All You Have, he writes about his life, the cases he's taken on, and how his faith in God was sometimes challenged, and how his faith in the justice system was shaken by police who lied on the witness stand, prosecutors who knew, and judges who turned a blind eye to the whole thing. Jim McCluskey is now retired, but still serving on the board of Centurion Ministries and still working on cases. He's a lay minister. Jim McCluskey, welcome back to Fresh Air. It is such a great pleasure to talk with you again, and I love your new memoir.
Well, thank you, Terry. It's great to be here. I'm happy to have returned.
So you were very religious as a child, and then you headed in the opposite direction. You became kind of wild. You served in the military. You had a good paying job as at a consulting company. So you went through these different phases of your life, but then you decided to go to Princeton Theological Seminary in around 1980. Why did you make that shift in your life?
Well, you know, I was 37 years old, and I had been in Japan in business for a number of years. And when I came back to the United States and began working for a Philadelphia consulting company by the name of Hay Associates, and things were going well there. But throughout the 1970s, when I was in my 30s, I became disillusioned with the business world, my place in it. I didn't find the work to be fulfilling. I didn't feel as if I was leading a real authentic life. I wasn't serving anyone other than the corporation and myself. And I went back to church for the first time in 14, 15 years. And I went to Paoli Presbyterian Church, And I really was impressed with our minister, Dick Streeter. It was a large suburban congregation. He was really touching the hearts and the souls of his congregants. And I looked at myself, and I wasn't touching the heart and soul of anybody, really. And I also, at the same time, became very serious and took a deep dive into the scriptures. And the next thing I knew, I was feeling a call to leave the business world and go into the ministry so that I too could serve the interest of others in a real significant fashion and maybe help change lives like Dick Streeter was changing my life. So I decided to go to seminary, give up the business world and go to seminary and become an ordained Presbyterian church pastor.
That's not exactly what happened though, because you took a detour. For your field work, you asked to be placed at a prison. You became a prison chaplain. And there you met the first person who led you to do innocence work. And he told you he had done bad things, but that he hadn't committed murder. He was convicted when he was 28 and was serving a life sentence. Why did you believe him? Because a lot of people say everyone in prison will tell you that they're innocent.
Well, I'd like to put that canard to rest. That's not true. in my experience anyhow. When I was a student chaplain in Trenton State Prison and met Jorge de los Santos for the first time, there were 40 inmates in each of them in their respective cells. So I was ministering, if you will, to 40 different inmates, and only two were claiming to be innocent. To my surprise, a number of them were telling me what they did. So most people, in my experience, don't say they're innocent, although somehow that has come to be believed by almost everybody. But anyway, Jorge, his nickname was Chiefie, C-H-I-E-F-I-E. And as soon as I met Mr. De Los Santos as a student chaplain standing before his cell, he claimed to be an innocent man of murder. And I didn't believe that. I thought, come on, that doesn't happen in America. We have the best criminal justice system there can be. And if there are any innocent people in prison, it's certainly an aberration and an isolated case. But there he was every time I would come by his cell and we would chat. All he would talk about was his innocence, and he didn't do it. And over the course of several months, I came to be provoked by his cries of innocence, thinking to myself, could this really be? Is he what he says he is, an innocent man? And then it started from there.
And he told you that he believed in God, but if God was going to help free him, it would have to be through you. And you seem to take that very seriously.
Well, here's what happened. I started the student chaplaincy work in September of 1980. And by Thanksgiving of that year, I was provoked by his cries of innocence. So I got hold of his trial transcripts, a lot of documents about the case, some 2,000 pages. And that's what I did over the Thanksgiving holidays. I read all the transcripts. So now I had the state's case and I had his viewpoint of his conviction, how wrong it was. So I asked him a ton of questions. And over time, I have to say that I was provoked. He was convicted based on what was obviously, even in my lay experience, an unreliable eyewitness account, plus a jailhouse confession where a career criminal had told Mr. De Los Santos' jury that the defendant confessed to him while they were in the county jail. Finally, when I came back from Thanksgiving and he said, did you read the transcripts? And I said, yes, they did. And he said, is there anything that I've told you that's not true? I said, no. He said, you've asked me a million questions over the last several months about my case. Now, I want to ask you a question. And I said, oh, boy, I wonder what this is going to be. So he said, do you believe I'm innocent? And I said, yes, I do believe you're innocent. He said, well, what are you going to do about it? I said, what do you mean, what am I going to do about it? I don't know anything. I don't know. I mean, there's nothing. What can I do, Chiefie? I've never had any experience of in the criminal justice system at all. I'm just a seminary student down the road here. He said, well, I've been praying for 6 years for God to send somebody to free me. You might not realize it, but you're that man. You're my angel to free me out from under this false conviction. I need you, and God has chosen you. He's talking, not me. God has chosen you to be that man. Then he really challenged me. He said, what are you going to do? Are you going to go back to your nice, safe, secure little seminary and just pray for me? I said, well, that's what I was thinking about doing. he said, that's not going to work. If you're a real man of faith, you're going to come save me. And that's all there is to it. I have nobody else but you. Well, he got me to thinking. I went back to my safe little secure seminary and did pray and think about it. Then I decided that, I think I have to do this. I have to take a year off from school and work to see what I can move the ball forward to try and free him.
Yeah, and you succeeded, which is really remarkable. One of the turning points was that a key witness confessed to you that his testimony was a lie. Tell us why he confessed and what he confessed to.
Well, his name was Richard Della Sante, which in Italian means of the saints. And coincidentally, Chiefie's last name was De Los Santos, which in Spanish means of the saints. And I will say this, that neither of the two were saints. but Chiefy was in my view, was not a killer. He was a heroin addict on the streets of Newark. But Richard DeLisante had also, I learned later through my investigation, that he was a longtime informant for the Essex County Prosecutor's Office up in Newark, New Jersey. They would use him in a number of cases to come in and give some incriminating testimony, false testimony, about a defendant. One of those was his own first cousin, Danny DeLisante. He testified against his own first cousin and falsely said that Danny confessed that murder to him. So I went to the DeLisante family, told them who I was doing, what I was doing, and they were still in contact with Richard, who was Danny's first cousin. And long story short, they introduced me to Richard. They kept asking Richard to please talk to Mr. McCluskey. If he's successful for Mr. De Los Santos, that will help Danny get freed. So it took a year until finally, in February of 81 or 82, I'm sorry, I got a telephone call out of the blue from Richard De Los Santos, and he said, "I know who you are. I know what you're doing. If you want to talk to me, I'm ready to talk to you." And when I visited him for two straight days, hours per day up at the Hudson County Jail in Jersey City, the reason he told me that he's finally coming forward and telling the truth after a number of false starts in the past, he said, "I'm just tired of living a lie. I'm tired of being the pinch hitter for the Essex County Prosecutor's Office. They've been running my life for 10 years, and I'm tired of it. And now all I want to do is tell the truth and get this off my conscience."
Did the prosecutor know that he was giving false testimony?
There's no question that he did. At Mr. De Los Santos's trial, under direct examination by the trial prosecutor, the prosecutor asked Richard De Los Santos, "Have you ever informed in any other case? Are you an informant?" And Richard said, "No, I'm not an informant. This is the first time I've done this." All the while, the prosecutor knew that that was a lie, because prior to the post-conviction evidentiary hearing, years later, we got access to the prosecutor's files, and there in the actual handwritten notes of the trial prosecutor, pre-trial notes, was the statement to Richard De Los Santos, "In habit of giving testimony." So we proved, and to the federal district judge's satisfaction as well, in his opinion, that freed and exonerated Mr. De Los Santos, Federal District Judge Frederick Lacey stated that the prosecutor knew that De Los Santos was an informant and had suborned perjury.
What an introduction to the justice system you had. False testimony by somebody who was like a pro at it, and then a prosecutor who was in on it and who knew about it, and a man serving a life sentence as a result of it. You must have just had this immediate cynicism after that experience.
Yes, I was starting to mature. I was starting to see the system with different eyes than when I first met Chiefy 2.5 years earlier. And I got a baptism of fire. I saw firsthand how police and prosecutors manipulate evidence, coerce witnesses into giving false testimony. You know, it was a stunner. And I started to really rethink my whole position on the integrity of police and prosecutors.
There must be such highs and lows in the work that you've done over the past 40 years. I mean, when you succeed in freeing a man or woman who is unjustly convicted, that must be such an exhilarating feeling. But on the other hand, even when you succeed in freeing somebody, it doesn't necessarily mean that they have a good life when they get out. It's so hard for many prisoners to make the transition back into life. I mean, you're coming to the outside world with like no money. You don't know what's been going on in the world because you haven't been living in it. You've been living in a cell for so long. And the first case that you took, the case that inspired you to do this work for 40 years, Jorge De Los Santos, you succeeded in getting him exonerated, But then he had a very hard time when he got out of prison. Tell us what happened.
Yeah, well, what happened with Mr. De Los Santos, tragically, was that when we freed him in the summer of 83, within 2 years, he was back using drugs heavily, descended into his addiction again, which led him to commit crimes, robbing. He robbed some drug user, as he had done before I met him. He ended up doing another 8 or 9 years in New Jersey state prisons as a result. And he was freed in the early, now by that time, we had faded from each other. He was so ashamed of how he led his life subsequent to us exonerating him that he just, I lost complete contact with him. He just felt so ashamed. He didn't want to talk to me because he knew what had transpired in his life. Anyway, he was found in about 1992 or so in a vacant lot in Brooklyn, murdered, beat to death. The supposition being that a drug buy went bad, and there he was. But let me say this about that, if I may, Terry. I still thank God for bringing him into my life, because were it not for that Newark-raised public housing project of Puerto Rican descent, who was a heroin addict, were it not for him, there would be no Centurion Ministries. Not only would there be no Centurion Ministries, but I would have been lost in the world, because as I think back on it, I would not have been a good church pastor. That just wasn't in me, as it turns out. So he gave me new purpose, a new life, and I treasure that new life. And I thank God for Jorge De Los Santos. So, and a point can be made that maybe the other 62 people that we freed might still be languishing in prison. And so I owe my life to that man. We gave him new life, and he chose to go in a different direction. And I don't hold that against him, because he just couldn't beat the drugs.
I think the fate of Jorge De Los Santos made you realize that you had to keep in touch with people after they were freed, people who you had helped to free, and help them establish their life outside of prison. So that's a whole other aspect of the work that you've done. You even had one of the people who you helped exonerate live with you for a while.
Yes, and you're absolutely right. Based on our experience at that time, my experience, because I was alone at that time, and with Mr. De Los Santos, and then when Kate joined me, we realized that we had another responsibility that we were originally unaware of, not only freeing these people, but working with them to help them regain their lives and reintegrate back into society after many, many years of wrongful incarceration. So that has become a major part of our work over the years. And that also, by the way, you think there's stress with trying to free innocent people from prison and get them out. There's a lot of stress attendant with these very personal situations of doing our best to work with those we free to make sure that do we do what we can to be their friends, not just their advocates, but their friends and their support system, at least part of their support system, as they go about regaining their lives.
You've been very successful with Centurion Ministries. Compare the number of people who you've helped exonerate to the number of people who you failed to exonerate.
Well, altogether, we've committed and have worked on behalf of 100 people across the United States, including 2 in Canada. 21 of those 100 are still in progress. So that means we've concluded our work on behalf of 79 people. Of those 79, we have been able to free 63 of them. That's about 80%.
That's amazing.
The other 16 or 17 people, we were unsuccessful in freeing for a variety of reasons. Two died while they were in prison. Two were executed. Five, we were just unsuccessful in developing new evidence or developing a new legal argument that had not been made before that we felt deserved judicial review. And finally, after we vetted cases very carefully and believed in their innocence and went to work for them, in seven different cases, we came to believe that our assessment of innocence was wrong, it was misplaced, and therefore we dropped them. We're not interested in freeing anybody who we have any doubts about their innocence. And so that's our record to date.
Well, let's take another break here. If you're just joining us, my guest is Jim McCluskey, a lay minister and the founder of Centurion Ministries, which works to retry and exonerate and free men and women unjustly convicted of crimes like murder. His new memoir is called When Truth Is All You Have. We'll be right back. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from E-Trade. Trading isn't for everyone, but E-Trade is. Whether it's saving for a rainy day or your retirement, E-Trade has you covered. They can help you check financial goals off your list. And with a team of professionals giving you support when you need it, you can be confident that your money is working hard for you. Get more than just trading with E-Trade. To get started, visit etrade.com/podcast for more information. E-Trade Securities, LLC, member FINRA SIPC.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Jim McCluskey. He's a lay minister and founder of Centurion Ministries, one of the first innocence projects dedicated to exonerating men and women unjustly convicted of murder or rape who are serving life sentences or are on death row. His new memoir is called When Truth Is All You Have. The first time I spoke with you on Fresh Air was in 1992, and you said something that has stuck with me all these years. You were talking about trying to maintain some balance between the urgency of your innocence work and your prayer life. And I want to play a short excerpt of that interview.
Has the work that you've done challenged or reinforced your faith?
Well, here's the ironic thing. I like to think that it is the work of Christ and God that I'm doing. But what I've noticed in the last several years is that even though I like to think I'm doing the work of God, my spiritual life is not as strong as I would like. In other words, I find I'm drifting away from my prayer life is not good. I don't read scripture like I used to. I'll go over to the Princeton University Chapel to sit and pray at lunch hour, and all the while I'm thinking of this case, that case. Here's what I have to do. I better get back to the office right now. So I don't like that, and it's something I have to work on to rebuild my meditative life.
I really understand what you're saying. You're just so obsessed with your work and with the mission of it.
That's right.
So you're going to try to clear your mind a little bit and open your mind more towards spiritual thoughts? Is that what you're saying?
Yes. I am not doing what I know I should do, and that is take the time and go back and reinvigorate my prayer life, my scriptural read. I get great sustenance when I read the scriptures and take quiet time and do that. And when I don't do that, I find myself not drifting away from God. And it's not good. It's not healthy. So I have to get somehow off this fast track, this whirling train that I'm on. You know, I leave Los Angeles on Tuesday, and then a week later, I'm in Grundy, Virginia, working on a death row case I've been working on for 4 years, and the guy has an execution date of May 20th.
Wow.
We're up against the wall.
Yeah, sure. So you're not going to feel very good about taking time off to pray.
Not really. Yeah. Not really.
So that was my guest, Jim McCluskey, recorded in 1992. Jim, that clip always resonated with me because so many people are so busy with their work, there's no time for the thing that sustains them in life, whether that's family, friends, music, art, literature, nature, prayer, you know, whatever it is. And I thought you framed that so well, you framed that conflict so well. Now,
reading your book, knowing the outcome of that case and the twists and turns, because you talk about that case in your book, that clip is even more meaningful to me. And I want to talk about that aspect of it. The case you were working on, where you felt so urgent about the deadline that was pretty immediate, was the case of Roger Coleman, who was convicted of a gruesome rape murder. You took on his case, but you got a little suspicious of him at some point because he refused to take a DNA test. And the reasons he gave you sounded kind of sketchy. What did he tell you about why he refused to take a DNA test?
Well, he told me that, Jim, I don't think that's a good idea because I've never told you this before, but I have had intercourse with one of the women who works here in the prison, and I'm afraid that they've taken my semen from her and somehow planted it in the victim of my case here. And I just found that to be outlandish. I didn't place any credibility in that. It then planted seeds in me about having reservations about his innocence, so I left the case for the next year. I said, Roger, I don't believe you. I don't like that reason. It doesn't make sense to me. I think you're just making it up. And I now have some questions about your innocence. I'm not saying I believe you're guilty, but I'm starting to have some questions. So I'm going to step away until you agree to allow DNA testing to go forward. A year later, he did, thanks to his new lawyer, Kitty Behan, who came into it, was a breath of fresh air. So the DNA testing was done. And I came back into the case for a lot of different reasons. Even though in those days, when the DNA was done in the early 90s, 91 or so, it still wasn't as definitive as it is now. It still left room for doubt. Roger was included in the people who had that DNA profile, but it was like 10% of the American population had that profile.
Yeah, it was inconclusive. The test was inconclusive.
It didn't absolve him. It didn't exonerate him, but it was still inconclusive, yes.
So you returned to the case. So remember in that clip, you felt this urgency that you had to keep working on this case because he was about to be executed. You were running out of time, and that's why you didn't have time to pray in the way that you wanted to meditate in the way that you wanted to. He was executed. Did you witness his execution?
I did not witness the actual execution. However, Kitty, his lawyer, and I were with him sitting on the cement floor outside his death row cell about 10 yards away from the execution chamber. He was executed by electric chair. We shared his last meal that night, which was a cold deliver pizza. And we were with Roger up until about an hour before he was executed. Then we were ushered off the death cell block. 14 years later, when DNA had really became absolutely conclusive and could identify biological evidence precisely, working with another lawyer, we convinced Governor Warner of Virginia to allow post-execution DNA to go forward. And we agreed on a Canadian lab to do the work. They did it, and they came back and were absolutely 100% certain. There was a mixed sample, and one of those definitely belonged to Roger Coleman. And therefore, one could only conclude that he was her killer. But I've invested in the game. I still have doubts about it. Still not certain. I'll be haunted until the day I die about whether Roger did it or not. So people are going to say, well, wait a minute now. DNA proved that he did it. Well, I've traced Roger Coleman's movements that night from 10 o'clock to 11 o'clock. The time of death was 10:30 to 11. Time and distance, I've spoken with everybody he's spoken to during that 1 hour, what time he was there, what they talked about. And I don't know how he had the opportunity or even the motivation to do this. It just confounds me.
You've had to live with so much uncertainty over the years.
Well, if you don't mind, Terry, I want to get back a little bit to my faith, if I can.
Yes, please.
Because years later, years after Roger was executed, I had another crisis of faith. Mm-hmm. Working on behalf of Curry Max Cook, a Texas death row inmate. Now, this is detailed in the book, but I was with Curry through three retrials throughout the 1990s. The first retrial was a 6-6 hung jury. Second retrial, Curry was reconvicted and sent back to death row. I investigated that case from top to bottom. I sat at the defense table during the trial, worked helping the lawyer. There's no question in my mind that Kerry Max Cook had nothing to do with this. I saw the prosecutors and the police and their witnesses lie after lie after lie, and we had a terrible trial judge who prevented us from introducing exculpatory evidence. The deck was stacked against us, and Curry goes back to death row, and we have to start all over again. I came home from that trial, and I said to Kate, my long-term partner, I said, Kate, I question whether God even exists. Where is God in all this? Does God really care what happens down here on earth? Does he intervene? Does he try and secure justice for all kinds of different people who suffer so many different kinds of maladies and evil? And so I checked myself into a retreat center, a Catholic retreat center, for a week to reexamine my whole relationship and belief system in Christ and God the Father. And I tried praying. That didn't work. I didn't feel speaking up to God was in any way connecting with him. So what I did, though, I went back into the scriptures, and I was reading the Sermon on the Mount. And I saw in Matthew where Jesus is telling his disciples, he says, it rains on the just and the unjust, and the sun shines on the good and the evil. So that's it. Is that the way it is? Lord, is that it? Regardless of whether you're good or bad or just or unjust, sometimes the sun will shine, other times it'll rain. It doesn't matter what you do or how you conduct yourself in life. And I said, okay, that's it. Now I understand the reality. That was my interpretation. And so I then went back to work with a different sense of where God is in all of this. And today, 28 years after that interview with you, my prayer life, by prayer, I mean speaking to God, praying to God, still is shallow and inconsistent. But the way I talk to God or have God talk to me is through Scripture. And my Scripture reading has become, since that day 28 years ago, much stronger, much more consistent, and alive, and is a real inspiration and source of strength for me. Now, I still struggle with some of the essential beliefs of the Christian faith. Was Christ resurrected? That's the bedrock. That's the foundation of Christian faith. I believe he was resurrected, but I've struggled with that over the years.
Let's take a break here, and then we'll talk some more. If you're just joining us, my guest is Jim McCluskey, and he's a lay minister who founded Centurion Ministries, which is an innocence project dedicated to reopening cases and trying to exonerate people who were unjustly convicted of murder or rape and are doing time on death row or serving life sentences. His new memoir is called When Truth Is All You Have. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air.
I'm Jen White, the new host of NPR's 1A. Take what you hear on Up First and dive deeper with 1A. This show listens to the beating heart of America. Expect a dynamic debate that asks America what it wants to be. This is a show for those who are relentlessly curious. Join me next time on 1A.
Let's get back to my interview with Jim McCluskey, a lay minister and founder of Centurion Ministries, one of the first innocence projects dedicated to exonerating men and women unjustly convicted of murder or rape who are serving life sentences or are on death row. He has a new memoir called When Truth Is All You Have. I want to talk with you a little bit more about your life. You've actually had an incredible life, and your book is just full of surprises. I mean, I first talked to you in 1992. We had lunch once together. I forget which decade it was. When my husband and I decided to get married, we actually asked you to marry us because you were right. A lay minister. And then you explained to us that as a lay minister, you didn't have the power.
Right.
You didn't have the authority to do that. So had to turn to someone else. But so
sorry about that.
Yes, no, we were disappointed. But you know, your book has things I never would have imagined about your life. I'll mention a couple of them. So when you were working in business in Japan, this was before you were doing innocence work. It was before you went to Princeton Theological Seminary. You were in a very deep relationship with a Japanese woman, and one day she says to you, "I'm going to America." She leaves. You don't hear from her. It turns out she's been married for years to a man in America. You had no idea. This was a really horrible thing to find out. A little later, you return to the States, and you start, and this really surprised, I was not expecting this. You always seem so straight-laced to me, so I guess I got that wrong. You had relationships with sex workers when you went back to New York. One of the relationships turned into a real relationship for a while. Why did you decide, who convinced you that you should write about it?
Well, I just felt that I had to be honest about my life and who I was and what I was doing is all part of what led me to the seminary, to change my life, to just completely transform, hopefully, as well as best I could, to transform myself. And when I gave this book to my minister here in Princeton, Dave Davis, and I said, "Dave, when you read this book, you're going to see that I've let a number of skeletons outside my closet. But I want to tell you, there are still some skeletons left in the closet." So, you know, and that's true. Now, I haven't bared all. I bared enough, as you can see. But no, you know, seriously, I just thought it was important to be honest about who I was. And, you know, I'm not proud of it, but that's what I did. All of us deserve some kind of redemption. And maybe by airing this out and being honest about it, this is my way of redemption as well.
You know, I'm going to get back to that first case that you took where you won. You were able to free him and have him exonerated. And when he left prison, you watched him reunite with his wife in the outside world. And it was very moving. And then you went home to the room that you rented in Princeton, turned on the TV, and just felt kind of alone. And I'm wondering if you felt that way a lot during your life, that you have all these relationships.
Yes, you're right. I mean, when I returned to my house, to the room I was living in, the house that was owned and occupied by an octogenarian, a delightful woman, Mrs. Yateman, in Princeton, I go back to my room after delivering Chiefy to his long-awaiting love of his life, Elena, and there they were together, clearly at that time, in love with each other. So I go back to my room, and there I am, a 41-year-old man with nobody like that, and in a sense envying Chiefy for having a love in his life. I had nobody to share that great day and victory with. However, you know, look, you can't have everything in life. And I have to tell you, Terry, if I were married, I don't think I could have done what I've done in terms of the founding and doing the work of Centurion Ministries. It would not be conducive to a good marriage life, okay? And so I am just thankful that I have stumbled upon this work and made it my life's work. And this is what has given me joy and love and satisfaction and a sense of fulfillment in life. To have stumbled into a calling that has lasted all these years is a real gift from God. You can't have everything in life. And I have what I consider to be the most important thing, and that's a mission to fulfill in this world.
Jim, it's been so great to talk with you again. Congratulations on your memoir and all the work you've done in the last 40 years. It's really been a pleasure to talk with you again.
Well, thank you very much, Terry. I really enjoyed once again talking with you, and you always ask great questions and you get down deep, and I appreciate that very much, so thank you.
Jim McCluskey is the founder of Centurion Ministries and author of the new memoir, When Truth Is All You Have. After we take a short break, rock critic Ken Tucker will review the new album by Haim, a group of three sisters. This is Fresh Air.
What do you do when you have too many pickles in Alaska and not enough pancake syrup in New Jersey? On the next episode of Planet Money's Summer School, we send supply and demand to the rescue. It's the economics education you always wanted but never got around to. Every Wednesday, listen now to Planet Money from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from WHYY, presenting The Pulse, a podcast that takes you on adventures into unexpected corners of health and science. Plastic in the guts of deep sea creatures, crying after anesthesia, building your own internet. Each episode is full of fascinating stories and big ideas. The Pulse, available where you get your podcasts or at WHYY.org.
The rock trio Haim played its first concert 20 years ago among the salamis in Cantor's Deli in their hometown of Los Angeles. In 2020, Haim would have headlined Madison Square Garden were it not for the coronavirus. Now the three Haim sisters have released their third album, Women in Music Part 3, and it includes songs about depression, loneliness, and dealing with condescending journalists. Rock critic Ken Tucker has this review.
You did me so bad when I was in the moment. Well, I didn't understand. Ooh, yeah. You did me so harsh. Left me low with my high heels in the parking lot. I always thought I'd see it coming. But I don't. Gotta leave the engine running in the front seat in my mama's winter coat.
Haim's Women in Music Part 3 features songs that radiate a sunniness so strong you'll think your ears are burning. Or maybe they're burning because you think Haim is talking about you. Take, for example, a great song like the one I'm about to play called The Steps. It gets at the way you sometimes wish the person you love would understand you better, which leads you to wonder how much you really understand or love that person. Steps has a guitar sound and a mood that reminds me of Fleetwood Mac around the time of Tusk, one of the greatest LA albums. The Haim sisters, Danielle, Esty, and Alana, are creatures of Los Angeles, creating songs meant to be blasted loud in your car as you try to time all the green lights along Sunset Boulevard. It's no surprise, therefore, that they include a new song called Los Angeles, or that at various times, their sound evokes such L.A.-rooted musicians as Crosby, Stills & Nash, Linda Ronstadt, and the Bangles. There's a sharp, cutting song about a sexist dude interviewing the band called Man from the Magazine. It's yet another example of Haim's Laurel Canyon pop, with what amounts to a Joni Mitchell impersonation in the vocal and a guitar riff straight off Joni's album Blue.
What did you really want me to say, babe? What's going on behind those dark glasses? Is this what you think of making it passes? Wondering which door could get me out fastest. When I tell it now, I don't want to hear. It is what it is, it was what it was. I don't want to hear. It is what it is, it was what it was. You don't know how I'm perfectly numb. But you don't know how it feels.
The sonic range on display here is both impressive and intriguing. I'll give you two contrasting examples. On All That Ever Mattered, the band goes intentionally crazy, distorting the vocals, replacing the naturalistic drum sound with programmed beats, and offering a squawking guitar solo that made me think of yet another Angelino, Frank Zappa.
So what is it like now that you don't have me? So what is it like that the man don't tell me? Do you think about all the things I did to you? Do you think about how to get me back when you remember that to me? All that ever mattered was you.
In contrast to that, here is I've Been Down, which sounds like an electrified piece of folk music. It has a simple and great melodic hook and a terrific drum sound from Danielle, spongy and sticky, yet propulsive.
I've been running around town, feeling up and down, taped up the windows at the house, but I ain't dead yet. Would you even pick me out in the crowd? 'Cause I can't recognize myself now, and I'm turning away hell.
There's a couplet in The Steps that compresses all the tension Haim creates in the best music on this album. The lines are, "Do you understand? You don't understand me, baby." As the speaker, heartbroken, answers her own question, it's the dark emotional space between those two lines that all the sunny music on this album has been created to illuminate.
Ken Tucker reviewed the new album from the trio Haim called Women in Music, Part 3. Tomorrow on Fresh Air, my guest will be Michaela Cole, the creator, writer, director, and star of the HBO series I May Destroy You. She plays a young writer, famous on social media, who's sexually assaulted, but she has no idea what happened because her drink was spiked. The story comes out of Cole's own experience of sexual assault. I hope you'll join us. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Teresa Madden, Thea Chaloner, Seth Kelly, and Joel Wolfram. Our associate producer of digital media is Molly C.V. Nesper. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.